Hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of the Hey Heretic Hammer podcast. I'm your host, Marshall, and this is my host, Dylan.
Hello, hello.
And are you ready to talk about war crimes?
We weren't doing that already. I feel like we were doing that already.
Right, but now it's in the name of the Emperor, the God Emperor.
Oh, okay. Well, that's fine.
That's right, because we're talking about it's happening. I'm excited talking about the Sisters of Battle, or the Adepta Sororitas.
Sisters of Battle.
And see, while in the 42nd millennium, you know, despite that kind of most general folk, right, believe in the imperial religion of the God Emperor, the thing is about the religion is that it's quite regulated as an official section of the Imperium. So this all, and you know, in the sense of like, it is like a branch, if you will, but the way that branch has worked, it's always been a little funky.
That's good. I like funky.
To get into the origins of the sisters, and we have to somewhat get into the origins of the cult and now religion of the God Emperor of mankind. So are you ready to deep dive in to these nuns with guns?
Absolutely. Let's start the sister act.
It's important to remember that the Emperor, back in the time of the Great Crusade, right, banned religious worship, right? There was the whole reason that inevitably Loagar fell to chaos was because the Emperor was like, you don't worship me. Because like Loagar wasn't bringing, but the thing is, right, that even in that time, there are many in secret that still worshipped him as a god, looked at him as a god figure.
I'm unsurprised.
Yeah, and well, and like I said, this was in no small part due to the planets that Loagar brought into compliance, because he was still up to that point that he got, you know, his religious cities spanked by the Emperor, bringing planets into this concept. So even though they may have like attempted to come down and be like, no doing this, many were still going to be doing it in the back, right? And so the horse hairs happens, all that. So millennium, you know, M32, or the 32nd millennium, rolls around, and this begins to grow a lot more, right? The Emperor has ascended to the Golden Throne. The ecclesiarchy was founded really like within the 1,000 years after the Emperor ascends. And a lot of them really holding to the Emperor's final words and how he spoke of protecting the Imperium and like from a psychic way, leading to his phrase, which inevitably led to them adopting the phrase, the Emperor protects, right? Because the Emperor said, like, I will protect this Imperium with my mind. You, my son, my remaining sons, must protect the Imperium with your bodies. And yes, granted, they didn't do a very good job when most of them disappeared for 10,000 or really 8,000-ish years. But thus around millennium 36, the ecclesiarchy had amassed so much political power that they essentially started to be able to effectively set themselves in charge of the Imperium as a whole. And a big reason for that started to kind of get into this idea that the main ecclesiarch, the head of the ecclesiarchy, kind of began touting themselves as speaking on behalf of the Emperor himself. Now, specifically that part really became the case with the eventual ecclesiarch Goge Van Dyer.
The hat is excessive also.
But yes.
He's out here trying to be like Pharrell Williams. It's a little too much. That would be.
Because as absolute power corrupts absolutely, or even those who see a possibility for absolute power, there will be those who will wish to take it. He attained power through bribery and a bit of a coup, thanks to some warp storms, making it kind of messing with the Imperium as a whole for a bit. And it made many of people lose confidence in the leader of the current ecclesiarchy. So Gouge took this opportunity to kind of like bring everyone together and be like, yeah, he sucks, put me in power. And like he, you know, bribed all these military people. So, you know, he had like a bit of, he had like soldiers and stuff. And then when he got into that power, right, he used those deals to be like, all right, I'm going to give you guys some cushy jobs. You just keep the Imperium in line under me. We'll be good. You know, the Emperor protects. God Emperor wills this. I know because mm-hmm. I can hear his voice. Totally.
Hashtag protect, not attack.
So shortly into his absolute reign, he hears of a planet of warrior women who have emphatically, you know, dedicated themselves to the worship of the God Emperor. And, you know, as a man who is trying to add more and more military protection, somewhat due to his growing paranoia, you know, and he kind of knows, like, at the moment, the Astartes are kind of distant and distracted. So this is kind of the perfect chance to have this blindly dedicated army for himself, because he kind of knows and they aren't really around inevitably do anything about it at the moment, but they're not going to be the ones to go right with him, right? It's going to be, they're likely going to be like, who are you? Get out of here. So he's trying to kind of amass this army. So this group of warrior women sounds pretty useful. And so he travels to the planet of San Lior. And then Gouge uses some technological trickery, because San Lior was an agri world and a fairly behind one. But he uses this by like essentially using a void shield, like a little just front facing shield that can essentially protect him from like a las pistol bolt or stuff like that. And he has it disguised as a rosary. So he's kind of like, the God Emperor will protect me. Watch as I will have my officer shoot me and I will not die. And so the officer shoots him. The shield goes off, but they don't know what that means. They just see it as this force and he's fine. So they all kind of fall hook, line, and sinker for this. They're in that sense of like just being totally oblivious to things, right? Where they are coming along and they're being like, told like, you know, your emperor believes in all of this and I am the word of him, so here you go do my bidding. Now these are, you know, these people don't believe in the emperor, they don't believe in, you know, his word. They've said no to the emperor and they're betraying us, but they were just his like political enemies, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it was one of those things where like they definitely could have maybe had a thought about it, but they didn't, because they just kind of, they felt like they saw, especially from their leader's perspective, saw with their own eyes. And so what were originally on their planet called themselves the Daughters of the Emperor, he now had his Brides of the Emperor, and he had instituted essentially what was called the Reign of Blood, where just anybody that opposed Gouge just faced imminent death, and his rule was all but law because he had just completely locked down all other forms of the imperial governance. Eventually, the Astartes do catch wind of what's going on back on Terra and are kind of like...
And they're thrilled about it.
Yeah, you know? They're like, all right, goddamn, okay, fine. Because in their defense... They were still busy.
Oh, this guy again.
Yeah, they were still pretty busy dealing with the scouring, right? They're trying to still hunt down all the Chaos Trader Marines that went around the Eye of Terror and are like trying to like come out and do counterattacks and do like, you know, warp based like ins and outs. So like it's not an easy part for them. But when they arrive, they have a pretty tough time getting to Gouge because of the sisters or the brides of the Emperor. And eventually the Astartes, you know, kind of talk to the custodians who have, you know, at this point were locked into their kind of, you know, they essentially locked themselves with the Emperor, you know, at this point, like we talked in the custodians episode. This was in that period where they were just not doing anything. Mm-hmm. And they were completely cut off. They had no idea what was going on outside of the Imperial Palace. The Astartes get through to them and are like, hey, this is going on. And so that's when custodian Longinus comes to finally take action with a group of the small group of his soldiers, and they essentially, after a decent fight, don't get me wrong, grab Alicia Dominica and her bodyguards, which were the main leaders of the then brides of the emperor. And he took them to the emperor himself, brought him to the throne, and like had them kneel to the floor and essentially be almost like, and were supposedly told the great truths by the emperor. And it was in this that these leaders of the brides or the sisters, you know, they come out and are like, "Where's that old fuck?" And they marched to Van Dyer and they beheaded him for the heretic that he was. Notably, his last words, because he had grown so paranoid and distant and just insane. "I don't have time to die. I'm too busy."
Wow. Deeply relatable.
You know, when you think about it, that was the end of the reign of blood. And then thus from that, the ecclesiarchy was forced to essentially disband all of their military forces. So, because originally at that point, they had the Fratres Templars, which were essentially the, you know, a soldier convent of the ecclesiarchy. Because even though they were technically working with members of the Imperial Guard at the time, that was like a hiring thing. So that's when the whole thing became, they made the rule, they cannot have a standing army, but they worded it very specially. They worded it as that the ecclesiarchy cannot hold men under arms, or cannot have men at arms. So how do you get sneaky, around sneaky. That? A bunch of women. And nope. So because of that, you know, there's somewhat a thought, right, to what level was this intentional, right? Because there maybe was some argument that, like, maybe the ecclesiarchy could at least hold, like, at least one force. Otherwise, some of it could kind of also just be, like, you know, like, because they could have also looked at the way that the sororitas were and acted in the battles and were like, well, that's not a resource we can give up, right? Like, this is a really valuable army, but they won't really want to not be part of the ecclesiarchy, right? So, like, where they, like, technically don't have to follow church guidelines and stuff like that. So it's a lot easier if we just kind of let them be a part of the ecclesiarchy. Otherwise, the other argument also could be they felt that maybe if they tried to disband them, that they actually may create some type of horrid, unregulated band of religious vigilantes that would make their lives just a living hell. So,
yeah,
I feel like there might be a little bit of both, but, you know, I think that had a lot more to do with it than just specifically just being like, "We didn't think about this. Oh my God, I can't believe, how did they find this loophole?" You know, I think despite all the dumb writing that GW can have sometimes, I don't think that's specifically one of them. I feel that it's one of those things where it's a purposeful loophole.
Yeah, no, for sure.
So when the Sisters of Battle, or Adeptus Sororitas, were founded, they then formed into having their own kind of set of orders. So because they, you know, they had to then create a hierarchy for themselves proper. So they have orders militant and orders non-militant. So we'll start with the orders militant because, all right, but yeah, so there is, you know, like I said, we'll start with the order militant because, and then we'll spend the most time on them because those are the ones you'll get most of everything about. And somewhat like Space Marines, where you have, you know, their legions with their Primarchs and then their chapters based on those legions and stuff like that. The sisters have Orders Majoris with their saints, having one point been the leaders of those, like, body, the Saint Dominica and, you know, her bodyguards, them making the Orders Majoris, and then at one point then making the many potentially infinite Orders Minoris that deviate in all their own slight ways. And they're divided between two, essentially, they're like, each of the Orders Majoris are like kind of split their headquarters between Terra and the planet of Ophelia 7, which is kind of known as like the Ecclesiarchy homeworld, quote unquote. Because like at one point they had moved the Ecclesiarchy there, then they moved it back. It was a whole thing. But yeah, so those are like the two planets essentially that like either are based on. Fact isn't really super important because all the sisters look at Ophelia 7 and Terra with a fairly similar reverence. Terra only more just because the Emperor is there, locked in a castle on a chair, but he's there. So let's start off with the most prominently seen of, let's start off with the most prominently seen of the sisters in the Order of Our Martyred Lady. These are the poster children of the sisters, and they were once led by Saint Catherine Eliseus, the shield of Eliseia Dominica, and otherwise known as her right hand. Now, originally, when Catherine was alive, and this was founded, it was founded as the Order of the Fiery Heart. And Catherine led them to great victories. She was declared a living saint, having performed, you know, miracles on the battlefield. However, she would be, which this will be a common amongst all of the saint leaders of each Order Majoris, was murdered for her by the witch cult of Menestis. And the sisters would grieve so heavily that they would rename their order Our Martyred Lady. And at the time would don an all black outfit, only adopting red later on after the fourth war for Armageddon. What's funny though, is like I said, they go for their patron, or yeah, they go for their patron saint so hard that they literally have a unit in the game called the Triumph of Saint Catherine, which is literally just a funeral procession that goes along throughout the battlefields to just like essentially be this, like, I mean, in game it's a buffing piece, but you know, in lore it's essentially this like big like thing of like, do the sisters need essentially like the greatest of morale boosts? Bring in the coffin.
Wait, is Saint Catherine actually in the coffin, or is it just like meant to represent her?
I'm gonna be honest, I'm not 100% sure on the answer, but I believe so.
Like, if they're doing a full coffin dance with Saint Catherine, like, it's cool either way, but that's like that might be one of the coolest things that you have shown me so far in this entire series we've done. Like, the idea of just like this full funeral procession going into battle with that is insanely cool.
It is absolutely awesome. The Triumph of St. Catherine is also like one of the coolest models in the game as a whole. Cause like I said, like this is just like legit, like a model in the game that you field on the tabletop.
Yes. Like, oh, that's so cool.
And like I said, like it gives like a bunch of buffs and stuff to the, like to the, you know, to like your other units and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole thing is like the leader is carrying like the shield of Saint Catherine. This is where one of the, again, those kind of muffled things of like, I don't know that it's technically the real shield of Saint Catherine, because the real shield of Saint Catherine is said to have been made partly with the Emperor's power armor, so that it can like repel anything. And I think this is meant to be more of a representation, because I think that if I remember from a different book, that shield is technically lost still. This is like a makeshift of it.
It's like the Mona Lisa that's on display versus the actual Mona Lisa. You know?
Right, exactly. But they go hard on their patron saint. And, you know, and like I said, they are inherently one of, like, they are the most prevalent when it comes to the writing and lore. They have a prominent or a prevalent number of characters. One of them includes Superior, Junith Rita, who similarly, in terms of cool models, I think it's cool. Other people don't. But she rides on this like giant pulpit, which like levitates over the battlefield and like shoots and has these two like massive heavy flamers.
It's giving Eggman in like the first, he's like the first boss in Green Hill Zone. When
you know
in
what?
His, like,
her hair does not help ship. Matters.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I
her
do
hair
like the
very
eagle.
Much does not. Yeah.
The two-headed eagle is dope.
Yeah, the Imperial Crest.
And
eagle,
the steps.
Cool.
Oh, man, dude, the writing on the steps.
Yes. They're the names of each dope. Of the patron saints.
Yes.
Of the Ordo's Majoris.
Marshall's faction is just like shooting up in popularity for me.
It is sick, bro. Yeah, so their whole shtick. Oh, yeah. So some of the other characters, then some of the which these rest of which we'll actually talk about in greater detail, is Ephriel Stern and Saint Celestine. We'll talk about them when we talk about characters. So their whole shtick is that they wish to follow in the way of their patron saint and seek to be martyred in battle. Now, I will note, this does not mean they just intentionally throw their lives into gunfire or take foolish risks.
Sure. Yeah.
But they fight with such ferocity and they look at the danger or like a dangerous situation that has to be done without the fear and like with the knowing that if they die, they are doing something right. And kind of the great way though they handle this balance in writing is to me is in the book Mark of Faith, where a sister named Evangeline is spared from death during a chaos invasion on Ophelia 7 during the Indominus Crusade. It's like the very beginning of it. And she is upset at the fact that while all of her squad died and essentially she was going to be essentially lit aflame, she was spared this righteous death. And instead, as feeling as others do on to her, that she was spared because of a greater purpose. She was given these marks on her face that somewhat represent the Imperial Eagle crest. She felt that she was given this undeservingly and in a way that being brought to life again was almost a punishment. And it's something that she comes back and forth through very frequently throughout the book and struggles with, because she felt that, especially that, you know, her sisters, whom of which she was the youngest of, all died, but she lived. And what is the reason for this, you know, and all that. Okay. And so it's one of those things where, like, it's a big balance of trying to figure that out, right? Of, like, why is she alive? So there's obviously more to it. It's a great book. It's worth reading for sure. But then otherwise, they have prominently taken part of the Indominus Crusade with Gilliman, who then they also partner heavily with the Ordo Hereticus of the Inquisition. They've helped them with multiple huntings and searchings. Thus also just because of book related things where they're just like, you know, we need help and these are the sisters nearby. So here we go. Next up, we'll go to the Order of the Ebon Chalice. This is the technical first order founded by Saint Alicia Dominica. They are similarly a well-rounded, if not more shooty sect of the sororitas. The highest members of the order learn part of the secrets learned in the Golden Throne by Dominica during the Reign of Blood. But in the Aaron Dominus, they have been a heavy shield for the Imperium on the inner portion of the Great Rift, preventing this giant coronate incursion of Chaos Space Marines from the Black Legion, essentially burrowing their way to Terra on this just giant berserker murder spree. Similarly, their saint fell in just battle, Dominica. I think she, if I remember correctly, she is the first of the saints to die. And the somewhat, again, sisters took somewhat to a similar level, but they don't kind of go as hard into the martyr stuff as our martyred lady. They kind of hold that, like, proper, we must be kind of a balance and leaders, right? So we must stick around because we have to lead the, you know, we have to make Dominica proud, you know?
Yeah.
Next, my favorite of the Ordos Majoris, in the Order of the Bloody Rose. Also, ooh, this would be Corrin's favorite order, as they are founded by Saint Mina, the Blade of Dominica. Gotcha. They are crazy heavy battle focused. Like, they are much, while they are much like those of the Martyred Lady, where they revel in combat and the possibility to die for the Emperor, they don't see it nearly as much in terms of our Martyred Lady in a chance to die, and more of a chance to spill as much of the enemy's blood as possible before they meet their end. Like, they would be happy to die, but they'll be happiest if they die surrounded by all the corpses of the bodies that tried to defeat them first and then just succumb afterward.
Okay.
And Corrin would love that fact. And in fact, mm-hmm, in one of the Rose books, which is in like the bigger collection, A Rose at War, they kind of go over that in a really cool way, where a Corrin demon or someone possessed by a Corrin demon tries to essentially like tell them, like, you're no different. You thirst for war. You thirst for battle. You know, you even been enraged or given power by battling and by spilling blood. You're no different than us. And, you know, they go over that, you know, and when the younger member of the order or of kind of the group asks the leader, you know, isn't that, you know, do you think he's right about that? Like, or, you know, he's, you know, feels like he kind of has a point. You know, her point to them is to say, you know, no, because we do this with a purpose. We fight for the Emperor. We fight for the Imperium. We are bringing righteousness. They slaughter and kill to slaughter and kill. They have no goal. They have no desire just to bathe in blood. They do not. They have a purpose still. They won't do so just for the sake of doing it or for the enjoyment of the killing. They will take enjoyment in defeating the enemies of mankind, but they won't just do it blindly. They are the most melee focused of the orders, and they're also known for charging into battle with the loudest of chants and prayer hymns. Similarly, showcased very well, especially in the audiobook of A Rose at War, and I'm going to guess, I haven't gotten to it yet, but The Rose in Darkness as well, which is the sequel book. Next up then, we've got the Order of the Argent Shroud. This was founded by Saint Silvana, and they're known for their silent altruism and hit-and-run tactics. The Saint Silvana was poisoned by assassins. They were either a death cult assassin or a Van Dyer lackey that maybe was trying to get revenge. It's not super clear. But they're the most apt at being shock troops. Their flying Seraphim and Zephyrim units are very deadly, and they will take hold of a battlefield in a very speedy and, you know, kind of very deliberate fashion. But their altruistic nature takes form generally in the sense of like one sister falling to save the whole squad, rather than like, you know, them trying to like send a bunch of people in to protect the citizens. It's a little bit more about like to each other kind of thing. They do act fairly independent in terms of not trying to follow too many of the, like, you know, if a noble's like, do this for me to help, they're just like, no, we're here to do our job, which is to kill these heretics, and then you can go shove it. Which is honestly the case with a lot of sisters' units, but some might be more beholden to it than others. Otherwise, next up, we've got the Order of the Valorous Heart. founded by Saint Lucia. This saint was martyred in torture by a heretical cult. They gouged out her eyes and had her listen to the tortured deaths of, I believe, hundreds of not only just imperial citizens, but even her own sisters, to break her faith and spirit. Though those sisters would not, they wouldn't make noise to not give pain to the matriarch that was suffering inside, knowing what was happening. While they were attempting to break her faith and spirit, they failed. This wasn't without them lying after they killed her to try to like boast their success, but they kind of just, all they did was get themselves tracked down and essentially forced to confess that they made that up and that she just fell from the pain but never truly broke. So now they're a bit death focused themselves, seeing themselves as kind of following in Lucia's example. But they will use the example of her resolve to show strength in the, in the face of great danger. So it's more that they kind of have just this kind of deep, maybe almost kind of dark outlook to, or what some would say, it's kind of like a dark outlook to, you know, their role and their inevitable outcome, right? They maybe don't try to again, somewhat similarly, they maybe don't try to fight or go against or get healing. Like when they get battle scars, those battle scars are part of their, you know, their person. That's a sign of the suffering that they are going through that they have shared with Saint Lucia, right? If a sister were to have lost her eye in combat, that is seen as a blessing because, you know, they are sharing in the pain that Saint Lucia exactly went through. However, they will also battle by doing essentially cutting off entire supply lines, starving out, creating almost deserts of battlefields, and just forcing into a deep attrition because of their greater resolve and almost self, you know, almost kind of like way that they intake pain with gratitude almost. They excel at. They do very good when that battle of attrition happens. Finally, of the Ordos Majoris, we have the Order of the Sacred Rose, founded by Saint Arabella, known as the calm and stoic warrior of the founders. They go through battle similarly with a calm and even demeanor to perfectly match their matriarch. These are definitely the most devout of all the sisters. While others will channel their faith through their actions or emotions, you know, like even the Bloody Rose, where they chant in great prayer, and they sing during battle. You know, you'll have their, similarly, you know, you'll end up having the Our Martyred Lady looking at them at their, you know, whenever they die, that their spirit is being given to the Emperor, all that stuff. They hold that, like, all of their strength, right? It doesn't come from, you know, it doesn't just come from their training, or it doesn't come from, you know, it doesn't come from the strength of the sisters around them. It doesn't come from anything but from having devout faith in the Emperor. They hold very true to the triumvirate of the sisters, which is the Bolter, the Flamer, and the Melta. So they're not as melee-y as some of the other sisters' orders. They're actually very shooting focused.
Oh.
With those kind of three main weapon types. They also then welcome ecclesiarchal followers and priests who essentially like to follow the sisters and witness the combat miracles that they inevitably will create.
Mm-hmm. Come along, school children. Let me show you something.
It feels that way, I think, sometimes. I think to them,
they
just
rip someone in half.
Yeah, they're just, they're willing to showcase that because they believe that that will show faith in the greatest way, you know? So then there are the Ordos Minoris, which there are many minor orders around the galaxy. The range, you know, from just smaller than you know, or being a single Garen, or again, redo. Then there are the Ordos Minoris, who range kind of from being just smaller than some of the major orders to being as small as almost as just a single garrison. Which, what this really does is it helps create creative options for armies on the tabletop, right? If you want to have, like me, where you have your own custom painted order, then you've got that going for you.
Mm-hmm.
There are the kind of three main orders non-militant. So the first being the Order Hospitaller, which are the medical members of the Sisterhood, so often traveling into battle with sisters and tending to their wounds to varying degrees of gratitude, depending on the order they're with. Those are the Argent Shroud, looking at you for maybe being not so grateful. there's actually a portion of a book that's all about that. So that is about three different martyrs. And one of them is a hospitaller of Argent Shroud. I do intend to read that someday for sure. But yeah, so they, you know, they are though still the medical units. They'll, you know, get a sister up to snuff and ready for battle once again. There is otherwise the Order Famulus, which I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that correctly, but we're going to roll with it. They're those who keep a sacred eye on the noble houses and their lines to obviously not only just keep lookout for mutations or showings of heresy, but, you know, obviously also just to kind of be that almost reminder of, like, remember, keep that good word.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, there are the Order Dialogus, which are translators of dialects of Low Gothic into, you know, putting them into Imperial, especially helping put them into Imperial Record, but also Sororitas, and also of Xenos texts to help, especially Ordo Xenos Inquisitors, tie their hunt or search for them and detect plannings of their, you know, of, you know, enemy warriors and stuff like that. You know, they just kind of hold mainly the, you know, that kind of mostly non-battle role, though they are still, they technically can go into battle about as much as the hospitaller do, but that's not like the main function. They would probably more do it like self-defense.
Is there some sort of like library or great reserve where they keep their translations at? Like, is there somewhere where they most collect all of these?
Are likely on Terra and Ophelia 7. Otherwise than just wherever the Inquisition, when they take them or something like that, you know, wherever they store them in their own libraries. But generally for anything that the sisters collect and take and all that, any type of information is going to end up at least main housing on either of the two planets. Or at least gotcha. Wherever the order is housed from. Because technically even some Order Minoris station themselves on other planets as their like home bases. But almost of certainty at some point it will make its way back to either of those planets. Otherwise, we can get into a couple notable characters. I mean, first and foremost, I mean, we have to talk about Abyss Sanctorum Morvan Vol. That's right. It's Morvan time, baby.
Oh my god.
Now granted, it is Morven, not Morben.
Morven.
But man, it great, great, and it's my favorite joke to make. She is the youthful total leader of the sisters. The Abyss Sanctorum is the top position of all of the Adeptus Sororitas.
Okay.
Yeah, she is the one in charge. She is the, you know, the Rebute Gorilla Man of the sisters. You know, she is currently in charge of everyone. Obviously, some people would argue about Gilliman at this point, but look, we all know that he is currently the leader of the Imperium. That's just what it is. I don't care if your Space Marines don't like to listen to him. This isn't about you. But yeah, she's a quite youthful leader. She was kind of brought into this role because it was left vacant for a long time because their original abbess had disappeared in a warp storm and was never found. Yeah. So they had left it vacant until she was either confirmed dead or returned. Because sometimes when you get lost in the warp, really what just happens is essentially you time travel forward in time. Like, you just end up 1,000 years in the future and you're like, damn it, we came out late. So that's what they're kind of waiting for. But in order to build up morale, they were like, let's put this young sister. She was a canonist still, but let's put up this young canonist into the ranks. She shows decent promise and she's young, so maybe we can manipulate her and kind of make her our political pawn, because that makes her, gives her a seat in the High Lord of Terra. She instead took to her command and decided, I'm going to do everything my way, and I'm not going to listen to anything that anybody else tells me to do. I'm going to lead the sisters the way that I know we need to be leaded. And so she got herself into this Paragon war suit called the Purgatora Mirabilis and would lead battles herself, currently taking crusade in the Phosphorus Belt of the Milky Way. Kind of right near that, again, that good rift in the galaxy. And fun fact about this suit, it has such a temperamental machine spirit inside of it that it will only accept the most faithful of people.
Mm.
So she essentially had to really wrangle this horse in to some extent, because inherently it was just more of like proving her worth, which she did.
Yeah.
Also incredibly good on the tabletop, but you know.
I was going to say, please, when we get to the tabletop, there's a miniature for this.
Oh yeah. And it looks just like this. You know, it's
fantastic.
It's perfect. Then we have Ephrail Stern, a member, as we talked about, of the Order of Our Martyred Lady. She is known as the Heretic Saint or Demonifugue. Mm-hmm. And originally, she had died when sent to investigate that there was a Slaaneshi demon called the Keeper of Secrets. So it's a greater demon. And it had trapped 700 souls of different sisters in what was called a soul cage. However, she died near this cage, and all of those sisters, their faith, because their consciousnesses, you know, were all still there, right? And so when you have all of these souls together, that means all their faith is together. So all of those sisters essentially use their combined faith to not only revive Stern, but place their souls within herself as well, helping to grant her psychic powers and essentially help her escape the demon and its followers while they were away and distracted. So now she is almost constantly able to hear the cries and words of all these 700 sisters that kind of work and live with her on a daily basis. And the other important part about her, and the reason that she's kind of called the Heretic Saint or the Demonifugue, is that the sisters do not accept or like psychers. And they're not ones to think that all of a sudden having these psychic powers is a gift in any way. And so since this time, you know, since that time, she was cast out of her order, brought back in, found that she wasn't really corrupted, but then was essentially almost essentially attempted to die again while fighting, trying to fight a Thousand Sun sorcerer, was revived again, kind of exiled herself somewhat choosingly and not choosingly. The Inquisition of the Ordo Malleus always kind of looking at her and thinking of her and calling her a heretic, especially because she escaped. She kind of ended up doing her own thing. but now actually uses her powers in somewhat a gauge of acceptance. Not in the sense that she looks at them as okay, but more in that I have them. I have them for a reason. I'm going to use them. And she now has also a Harlequin sidekick in the name of Kai Gonnell, who was also rejected by his peers and travels with Ephrael as they kind of try to seek new purpose together. And there's a reason that this heretic saint kind of gets used in this more recent book by David Annandale called Ephrael Stern, the Heretic Saint. But that goes, that's because it's recent enough, that goes into some spoiler territory. So you got to read it for yourself. Otherwise, next up is Saint Celestine. She is the living saint and of somewhat, I guess, technically formally, but still of the Order of Our Martyr Lady. She is the living saint, but she was kind of looked at as a normal saint at one point, right? The, you know, those who generally, you know, die because she had died in battle and she was thought dead, but instead was reborn with these great wings and this blade of righteous flame and fury, and would showcase almost a halo glowing around her upon revival. And seemingly the whole thing about her is she like will show up when, if you know, you're in a battle and you're in, you know, a, you're in great need and danger. The concept is that when it seems the most dire, Saint Celestine will appear and help turn the tide of the war. You know, this has somewhat happened on multiple occasions. One of the most notable being on Cadia during the that last Dark Crusade or Black Crusade. However, that didn't really turn the tide, but it helped make, yeah, or help, you know, stem the amount of losses in the end, right? Because it, inevitably it was beginning to somewhat turn tide, but then, you know, Abaddon throws a giant ship thing into the center of the planet, and, you know, a living saint even can't do really a whole too much about that. She isn't, you know, she's not Starkiller trying to bring a, trying to prevent a Star Destroyer from crashing into the planet.
Thank you for using a reference that I understand. We don't talk about Force Unleashed enough in our Warhammer podcast.
You know, but so it was within this then that she was declared, or, you know, after the initial times and all that, she was declared a living saint. While she doesn't fully understand and continues to seek understanding of her, what her powers mean and all that, she embraces it and knows what the meaning of her arrival does for the people and for the soldiers and for the sisters. And so she takes it in stride and works within it. The likely real explanation of it, above, like, if you were to kind of look at this from like a outside perspective type thing, essentially she's just a demon. She's a greater demon of the Emperor. Is really what she is, right? Sure. Because the whole thing is the Emperor is probably effectively almost ascending into some type of, some would say chaos god, some say he's like becoming the order god. And so the concept kind of is that Celestine is the order demon, or the greater order demon of the Emperor. And she's not the only one who is gone into any form of living sainthood, but she's the one that's the most prominent and the one that has the most stuff written about her. So, and she has the model, and because she has the model, she's the one that gets talked about.
Yep.
Otherwise, obviously there are plenty of other characters that have been in books, but these are definitely some of like the most widespread, especially the ones that have their own character name models. And like I said, there are a couple. Like Junith, while I talked about her earlier and showed her pulpit, there's not actually a whole lot when it comes to lore about her, so I don't really, there's not much to say. All right, otherwise, let's talk about some other notable units. So as I somewhat talked about, there are the notable jump unit of the Sororitas, which is the Zephyrim or Seraphim squads. Zephyrim are the ones that use melee weapons, specifically power swords, and then will use a pistol as a secondary, like along with it, where Seraphims will dual wield them pistols. So those are the ones especially that the Argent Shroud will make heavy use of in both of those, but especially the Seraphims. Otherwise, next up, you've got Paragon War Suits. These are similar to the ones worn by Morven Vall. They are just walker units that the sisters somewhat more recently have adopted. They were introduced in 9th edition, and they are a little controversial in terms of people's opinions. I think they're cool as shit. Some people don't really like the fact that, like, you can kind of see their, like, arms, you know, almost kind of like they're in, like, a carrier-esque thing. But
it's like a power loader type situation.
Yeah, and I think that part is honestly kind of cool. I actually like the fact that, like, you know, they have to use their arms to, like, control the machine still. And it's not just purely a remote or, like, a full, like, suit. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like if it was fully encased, I don't feel like it would, like, I mean, it would be cool still, right? But, like, I just like the fact, especially with the sisters being so focused on, like, being a part and into the battle, that I feel like if they were fully encased as, like, a mech suit, you know, or whatnot, that it wouldn't feel like it fits that level of, like, you know, we are going into battle personally. Though I will note, if you put the helmets on them, which, for, you know, when I am putting models together, you can almost sure as shit bet that I am putting helmets on almost any model I can, because I hate painting faces. It makes it look nicer, and you kind of get a little bit closer to that, like, encased feel, so I think it makes a good middle ground.
I like it. I think it presents this kind of, like, unique silhouette to it that you don't always necessarily see with, like, other quote-unquote, like, power armor or power suits and things like that. I thought the same thing when you first showed me Morven. I was like, yeah, that's a really cool, the fact that, like, her arms are clearly there. You can see how she's actually going to be kind of manually moving the larger arms of the suit itself. Like, I dig that.
So next up, then, you've got your Celestian Sacrosants. Sacrosants? Sacrosants? I don't know. They go into battle with a large shield and either a large, they have kind of these heavy mazes, or a halberd, their leader carrying the Spear of the Faithful. And they are one of my favorite units that also came out in 9th edition. Like, aesthetically, like, I love them. Because the old thing that they kind of replaced was the concept of a Celestian squad, which what that generally meant was that it was a squad of veteran sisters. They had seen many battles. They had won many battles. And so, therefore, they somewhat hold a higher level of not only training, but practice. So they kind of shifted that to them being the Celestian, kind of replacing the whole concept, because at that point, it ended up kind of being three data sheets for one, like, the same looking models. So the Celestian Sacrosants kind of were then to be the elite veteran squad replacement. Otherwise, I want to get into a couple of special units before we get into vehicles. Because the reason I'm going so in-depth, especially on, like, some of these that I didn't in the other one, A, because it's my favorite and this is my time to gush, but B, They're really unique.
Your bias is showing.
Yeah, this is also where the beginning of my joke I made at the beginning comes into fold. So first, we're going to start off with the Repentious Squads, which are Sisters of Battle that, for whatever reason, from their own admittance or the admittance of their uppers, have failed duty or the emperor or committed a crime or heresy in one way or another, right? So, and like I said, this can be self-brought, right? A sister can feel that she failed an objective and she should go to Repentia. A superior can think that they failed their mission so bad that they should go into Repentia. And what it is you cast off all of your power armor and rush into battle with these giant two-handed chain swords, and you either live and you gain repentance by surviving in battle, or you die and you gain repentance by dying in the name of the emperor in battle.
If they decide that they need to seek repentance, but they're like in the chain of command, like the person above them doesn't agree with that, does that not affect anything? Is it still like, nope, they feel like they need to strip themselves of their power armor, they need to go through this, so that just supersedes anything else? Like, it's, that's what they're going to do.
There is maybe a scenario, right? If it just seemed really egregious or whatever, or they have a need for them at that moment or whatever, right? There's possibly an exception to the rule. But generally, mm-hmm. the rule is no. Because many of the sisters don't look at those in the Repentia. They don't look down on those in the Repentia. Some of them even are kind of jealous because they get to go into battle without fear, without any form of protection, and it's almost kind of that kind of like security. And so you get that, it's that freeing feeling kind of like, I'm just throwing caution to the wind. And, you know, that is kind of what's, and you know, that's respectable to a lot of sisters that they're going along with it and that they're willing to do it. However, there are those who maybe don't feel that they wish to be in Repentia, and there are those who, like, are there as punishment. And then there are those who try to avoid said punishment or betray again. And they get slapped into mortifiers.
Oh, dear God.
So there's two types of mortifiers. There's the open casket and the closed casket.
Oh, that's horrifying.
Yeah, so these are living, you know, living, breathing sisters who have been slapped to these machines, and they move forward through nothing but the sheer pain that is being pumped through them by the machine. Yeah. And it will just charge forward into battle. And not only that, but they'll be given constant pain stimulants to essentially, and like adrenaline, to keep them alive as long as humanly possible. And the worst thing that can happen is to be given the closed casket, because the thing is, you can see they're blind, right? They have a shroud mm-hmm. over their eyes, and that's part of the pain, right? That they can't see the death coming for them. So to have the closed casket means that you're even more ruined, because you're going to be in that for a long time, because it's going to take a lot to burrow through that thing.
Is the closed casket like an Iron Maiden? Is there like anything on the inside that's like...
Only just the continued pain stimulants that go into it through the mortifier itself. Otherwise, for those who aren't part of the sisters and want to give a similar treatment to the to those of heretical nature, there are the mortifiers, which work essentially very similar to the way... Or not the mortifiers. Start that again. To those who aren't the sisters, but they feel deserve a similar fate to that of those who would go into the mortifiers or even Repentia, but aren't sisters, they get to go into the penitent engine.
Mm.
Similarly, they are given just a bunch of pain stims and battle drugs and just sent to town.
That sure sounds like fun.
It sure is. So yeah, the big thing about that then being, they somewhat similarly are just kind of sent in to reach their demise. You know, they're not given the same level of just like of staying alive juice nearly as much as the mortifiers. They're kind of just more designed like you are generally some type of criminal in some capacity. Your only way of repentance and savior is to just go and die in this machine. Similarly, for criminals, there is also getting arcoflagellants, where, you know, when we talked about servitors back in the Mechanicus?
Yeah.
These are those. But instead, they kind of are servitors that then kind of get this, like, pacifying helmet, which just turns their brain off for a while. And then when they get put into battle, it just shunts on and they just run forward and they just start attacking whatever they are sent towards. And with these kind of like electro whips that they have.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a similar thing. Just these are criminals. They got servitored already, but then they get the benefit of, they're just going to use them as essentially just cannon fodder. Just go in and waste bullets and die.
We have very different definitions of benefit, but I get what you're saying.
Yes. Otherwise, vehicles.
Woo, so, vehicles. Never mind all that.
So the thing is, a lot of the sisters' vehicles are based on the Rhino, which, you know, is a what was generally a Space Marine travel tank. Which if you were to essentially cover the whole Top Gun thing that you're seeing here in this image I'm showing you, that would be a Rhino, where it's just that chassis, that tank looking sure. World War II like World War I/II looking tank chassis.
Very, very iconic 4th of July yeah. tank firework chassis. Yeah. yeah.
They have the Castigator, which just adds an actual tank gun on the top. So it just looks like a real World War II tank. But then they have two really fun ones. This one being the Immolator, often adorned with some type of like stained glass or heraldry on the top, being flanked by two Meltas or heavy flamers. That is a transport unit and will transport some sisters into battle, flaming all of those in its wake. But the main reason we had to talk about these vehicles is called the Exorcist.
Okay.
Have you ever wanted to have a pipe organ missile launcher? Because that's what attached? We're looking at.
Is it attached to an actual organ?
It's what it seems so. It's one of, like, because obviously, like, when you look at it, the top section clearly has a bunch of missiles coming out of it, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like, it's very clear that's the case. But when you look out the top, you can see, like there is a keyboard or like a keyboard looking almost device in the top because it'd be piloted from the inside. So the person on top is only shooting the organ missiles, of which there seems to be actual pipes behind said pilot.
Mm-hmm.
So it does appear to be both an actual organ and a pipe organ missile launcher because there, as you can see, there are missiles in those pipes.
Most of it defaults back to we did it this way because it looks cool, and that's always going to be the case. And that is clearly the case with this. It's like
that's very much the case.
We designed it this way because it looks super cool.
All right. Yeah, no, that is 100% the case. And yeah, so I mean, other than that, we can kind of finally get into, you know, how they play in game. And the way that they play in game is kind of a mix between, which is actually, I think, in a good balance between they very much. So when you get them it'll always be that thing where, like, you'll see them and then you'll see, like, a Space Marine data sheet or even maybe a couple of others, right? Because you'll be like, they're in power armor and they have these cool, they supposedly have these cool weapons. Like, they're like Space Marines. They have bolters. They have flamers. You know, they have heavy flamers. Why do they not, why are they nowhere near as strong as the Space Marine? And again, outside of the lore reasons for that, the reason always, and Bricky has like noted this as like a good, like, and this is like a, he kind of puts it really well, where it's like the sisters are always mediocre, like, unit data sheets, but then have amazing rules and abilities. So, like, the game really pushes their, like, creating miracles on the battlefield and, like, being, you know, exemplars. So, like, they have what's, you know, their whole army gets what's called an invulnerable say, which is just like, even if somebody were to hit you with all of the armor piercing rounds in the world, as long as you roll that invul save, no negative to your roll can affect you more than this.
Oh, okay.
And so, like, that's, and then, you know, they get miracle dice, which are like dice you roll at various parts of the game, and they can replace, instead of rolling for like a save or attack or whatever, you can just, like, say you rolled one of your miracle dice as a six, you can just take that six and be like, this, I rolled a six instead. Now, it could be anything. It can be anything between one through six, but I'm just using that as an example. So, like, they are very much around, like, their abilities, and they are kind of this, like, and now they're rightfully there, where they're meant to be kind of this, like, not fully elite, but not a horde army. You know, like a normal-sized army. And they always do really good with a balance. They can get very character heavy, and it's kind of okay to do so, unlike maybe some armies. But they really kind of focus into that. It's that, like, miracle stuff. And all of their detachments and all that throughout history have always kind of been around the various concepts that the sisters go through. There's not a whole lot of melee benefit this time around, outside of the Repentia-based rule set. But
okay,
they still get really good stuff from their own rules to benefit that and then other things, right? So, and the stuff they do have is still slaps pretty hard. Like, they came out with this codex and had to immediately, technically before the codex even fully released, and they had to, like, hyper nerf all of their, like, cost to field an army, because when you make an army, they have a certain amount of points that a unit, and then you, like, go up to 2,000. They had to bring all those points up a bunch because they made them so strong that, like, in that preemptive stage of people getting early copies, were just demolishing. They were, like, if they didn't do it, they would have been the most broken army in the game. It was going to be a bloodbath. So they did the right thing, and they fixed it before it came out proper. And they generally kind of always play that way, where they might fluctuate because depending on rules changes that GW makes to the game, it can generally end up helping or hindering them in various ways. But that's kind of the nice part, is that you can kind of build your units how you want, because you kind of get to utilize, like, well, this unit has this ability and I want to use this ability with this and make this other thing work, instead of it just being like, this has good guns, so I'll use it, and that has good sword, so I'll use that. Yay. It's like, I like this ability. This goes well with this ability. So it's kind of like building almost like a Magic the Gathering deck in a way.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
But that's it. Any questions about our Adeptus Sororitas?
Marshall, I got to be honest. I like him a lot. I don't like the torture machine part. Don't love that. I feel like that's kind of the, like, the red flag on the third date kind of thing. But otherwise, very, very cool. Extremely cool faction.
I mean... The one kind of beneficial note is they don't come up in the lore a crazy amount, but they're those things that exist. They sit obviously as kind of like somewhat as like the meme of them being like, you know, they've got the walking war crimes, but it's, you know, they have so much else going for them. And I don't field any penitent. I barely field any penitent units. I only have Repentia squad. Because, yeah, they're not my favorites either. I most prefer the power armored, you know, nuns with guns, right? That's the thing I love about the Sisters.
Yeah, I'm down for that.
Because they have the great balance of being... And it's kind of why I think a lot of their books have been getting really popular. In that, you know, they have the benefit of kind of almost acting like super soldiers without being like genetically enhanced, but because of that, still having a lot of their humanity with them. But other than that, you can join us next week. That'll do it for this episode. I will once again go on that realm of, I don't know what we're going to talk about next week, but it'll be something. But otherwise, see you later.
Goodbye.